I welcome you to the Holistic Health Show. I am Dr. Carl O'Helvey, your host. My first guest, Caroline Blazovisky, is a national healthy home expert with over 18 years of experience working with the public and physicians to create healthy living spaces and improve wellness. Her certifications and education include knowledge of mold, indoor air quality, chemicals in the home, green building, healthy homes, and allergies. Caroline was featured in AARP in 2016 as a leading healthy and safety expert, is a regular guest on Sirius XM Radio, and works with leading physicians all over the country. She is in public education, in the media, radio, television, and print. She is also president of My Healthy Homes, a green company that offers testing services, products, and consultation for homes throughout the United States. Caroline is a certified mold remediator, a certified indoor environmentalist, a healthy home specialist, and has sustainable design certification from Boston Architectural College and philosophy political science degrees from Muhlenberg College. She is currently a graduate candidate in preventive medicine and public health at Keck School of Medicine at the University of Southern California. More information is available at healthyhomesexpert.com. I welcome you to the Holistic Health Show, Caroline, and I look forward to hearing about home experts, mold, and other home infestations. Now first, what is a healthy home expert?
Well, a healthy home expert is something that I kind of came up with and created about 17 years ago when I started realizing that there were aspects of health that were sort of overlooked. And I myself had allergies and sort of was left years ago with no answers as to why things, you know, what caused allergies and what were sources of allergies. So I went back and became educated in all sorts of different indoor air quality issues and different environmental factors, environmental health. And so my job is to work with physicians and homeowners to create healthier living spaces to help improve wellness.
Mm-hmm. And Caroline, how do you work with physicians and homeowners to improve wellness?
We started designing with physicians. We started obviously offering test kits. We're located in the tri-state area. So we started originally doing the tri-state area locations. We would go out and test for indoor air quality issues, from air testing to sampling to investigations, inspections. And then we developed test kits that could be used throughout the United States and also internationally that allowed physicians to be able to test their patients for environmental health issues, whether that be mold, volatile organics, or proteins. So we developed kits that doctors could use with their patients. And that became, how we started working nationally to help improve patient wellness.
Mm-hmm. Great. And what are the major contributors to poor health in a home?
Well, the interesting thing is there's just so many things in a home that can go awry. And I think when homeowners purchase a house, they sort of think, well, I don't have to do anything. I just bought this house. And the maintenance on a home is quite significant. You probably know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So when you have to try to test for, you know, different things, water intrusion, having leaks, making sure your gutters are cleaned out, making sure you don't have radon, that you don't have lead, that nobody's smoking in the house. When we start to look at houses, we really realize that there's a lot of factors that can really contribute to poor health. And we do spend 8 to 10 hours a day sleeping in a room, and breathing in that air. And some people spend more time, as people age, in particular, over the age of 65, you're going to be spending even more time at home. So these issues become very important to look at, especially like the elderly community. When you're over 65, you become more susceptible to particulate in the air, And that's an issue where HEPA filtration, like HEPA filters, become really, really key to helping improve cardiovascular function. There's been quite a few studies out of Switzerland where they really show that using HEPA filtration improves your cardiovascular function significantly, especially over the age of 65.
Mm-hmm.
So we start to realize this particulate, if people live in city, you know, city locations, that they're going to be affected a lot more. So there's a lot of things in the home that can really affect people.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my job to look at what's going on and see if we can improve health by what conditions we have.
Then, Caroline, how can you reduce mold, VOC, proteins, dander, and other indoor contaminants?
So molds obviously are, you know, a concern when you have any kind of water damage, but also when your relative humidity gets too high. So some people think that you have to have, you know, water intrusion, a flood, a leak, to have mold, and that's just not the case. What happens is when you've got, in the Northeast in particular, and in different parts of the country where we have colder versus warmer temperatures that meet, we'll see a lot of condensation. So, for example, if you have a basement that is very cold, and then you get an influx of a day where it's 70 degrees, those two temperatures meet on that block. You have a cold block, and then you have warm air, and mm-hmm. you'll condensate and form moisture. Just similar to if you put a glass out, you know, a cold glass of lemonade on a hot day, mm-hmm. you're going to sweat. It's the same thing that happens in homes. And so when that happens, guess what? Mold says, hey, I've got a great mm-hmm. source here. I've got my food, and now I've got some water, and I can start to grow or proliferate. And that becomes an issue for us because we don't want to see mold growth. And so the biggest thing people can really do in those cases is to try to reduce the relative humidity in the home.
Mm-hmm.
And simply, you know, just getting a little monitor, go down to a local hardware store and you pick up, you know, a simple monitor that tells you temperature and relative humidity. You keep it in your house, preferably on the bottom level. The lowest level of your house is the best. And you watch it. And you want to stay between 30 and 50% with relative humidity.
Mm-hmm.
And that in itself, just that simple free tip, can prevent dust mites, it can prevent mold spores, it can prevent bugs from coming. So, because these things are just like us, right? They need food, air, and water to survive. And if you don't give them those resources, they're not going to come. So just controlling your relative humidity in your house is a very simple thing. It's free, doesn't cost a lot, and it really can keep people a lot healthier.
Mm-hmm.
So do you live in an area that has a basement, or do you live in an area where you get a lot of moisture at all?
No, we don't. I have a first floor, but it's in the flood zone, so it would be like a basement because it's where I keep my car. And mm-hmm. there is a room that's heated and cooled, but I don't put anything in there because we flood. And
that's
it's
right.
built such that it's on pilings, and the walls are supposed to break away. But during Isabel, they didn't break away, but we had 3 feet of water through the house.
Mm-hmm. And people think that you have to just have water to have that, but you don't. That obviously will contribute to mold growth, but mm-hmm. also just the changes in temperature that happen in houses, or if they're not built correctly, or they're built partially into the ground. You know, you've seen houses that are what I call on slabs, or
mm-hmm.
You know, partial walkouts. They're prone to problems, especially in different climate. So, you know, especially where you've got the change in temperatures a lot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Then are there things that will improve the outcome for patients with cancer, autoimmune conditions, and other health issues?
Yeah, definitely. So what I've kind of coined as a phrase is what we call the trifecta. And what happens as an environmental consultant is when I go into environments where I see multiple contaminants or multiple situations that are not conducive to health, I'll see a patient that has cancer, or I'll see a patient who has autoimmune disease, or just overall ill health. And these things are, so for example, if you have mold in your house and mycotoxin exposure, and then you also have high volatile organic compounds, and then you're also spraying pesticide, when you get this trifecta, and it can be different trifectas, different mm-hmm. things that add up to that trifecta, but when you do, chances are you'll have someone with health complaints. And I've seen this time and time again. I've been a home inspector now for 17 years. So I've seen quite a few homes. And when we do have issues of health, whether it could be someone has cancer, it could be someone has you know, an autoimmune condition, thyroid issues, you know, cardiac issues, we'll see that these trifectas occur, and then we leads us to believe that it's promoting a lot of systemic inflammation, and the body just can't keep up. It's not really that the body is not functioning as it should. It's just the body's overwhelmed, and, mm-hmm. and that's what we see with this trifecta, which I think is really important. And my job is to look at it and reduce those things. We don't expect the body not to be exposed to anything, because if your body's really working, ultimately, it can take a lot of insult, and it just keeps going, right?
Mm-hmm.
But when you get these multiple insults simultaneously is when it seems to really slow up the body, and the body says, uh-oh, I just can't keep up, and then other things take hold.
Mm-hmm. And why is mold bad for us, and how does it affect us?
So mold is an interesting creature, and we've learned a lot more about it over the years than we originally knew. And so it does three things. So mold is that fuzzy thing you see growing on a piece of fruit or in your shower, which contains a spore, or is a spore. And that spore contains what we call beta-glucan, which is similar to a sugar, or is a sugar. And that beta-glucan causes a protein, which causes allergies in a subset of the population. So that's the first thing. So now you've got a spore that can produce allergies and inflammation. The second thing that molds do is, as they sit there, I say they kind of like smoke cigarettes, as they start to colonize and form their individual families, they start to outgas chemicals. And
mm-hmm.
that's what we call an MVOC, similar to paints, right? People always talk about VOCs mm-hmm. and paint. Well, molds actually produce a volatile organic as well. So that's called an MVOC. So now they're proteining it up and MVOCing it up. And then if you get certain species of mold, or you get multiple species, molds are colonizing, and they're actually very territorial. And what they'll do is, if you have a lot of species, they try to protect their own food source. They're very smart. You know, they're like people. They'll start to put off a mycotoxin, and they'll try to kill off the other species that are invading. So that's why when homeowners leave mold problems or water moisture problems and don't deal with them, they'll start to get excessive colonization that happens. And when that does, you get this mycotoxin exposure, because these molds, if they have the capacity, will put off extra mycotoxin.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that mycotoxins now have been associated with all kinds of, you know, cancer issues, and then certain ones are carcinogenic. And can do all kinds of, and disturb all kinds of mechanisms in the body and how the body can absorb and function. So molds do these three things. They put off a mycotoxin, they put off a volatile organic, and they put off a protein. And that's why when having them in the house, they can really contribute to a lot of health issues, and it makes them quite problematic. And so if you have them, you really don't want to be exposed. You want to be able to try to remove them, especially if they get to a high quantity.
And how do you remove them?
So molds, I recommend to my clients that they test every 3 to 5 years. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, doing this a lot, you can go and find mold almost everywhere. You know, mold is because we bring water sources inside and
mm-hmm.
have showers and bathrooms and
mm-hmm.
kitchens. That doesn't make me concerned. What makes me concerned is when the level gets high, exceedingly high, you get molds that can produce this mycotoxin, and you start to have abnormal levels. You know, from, I would say, a little low level isn't going to concern me as much, but when it starts to get medium or high, or if you have what we call water damage indicators, which are molds that produce mycotoxins that are associated with water damage, they have to be addressed.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the molds that in a fungus can cause serious health effects. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, I'm not looking for none necessarily. I'm looking for cases where they really could contribute and be causing health problems.
And what do you do?
So basically, I mean, you want to do a test every 3 to 5 years. And see where your levels are. So you kind of get a baseline. You know
mm-hmm.
if you've got something
mm-hmm.
going on, and you can watch it. That's the first thing. And as levels start to get higher, you can tell when you have to replace your bathroom, when you have to replace kitchens. These things are not, you don't put a kitchen in and then just expect to get 50 years out of it anymore. And the same with the bathroom. 25 years is like my threshold. If you've got a bathroom or a kitchen that's really over 25 years old, because we bring in water sources and things condense and
mm-hmm.
condensate, you know, behind the scenes, you have to redo them. So that's why houses are not, you know, just set it and forget it. It doesn't
mm-hmm.
work that way. You have to stay up on this maintenance. And that's, you know, a lot of it's general maintenance. If
mm-hmm.
you do have a toxic mold problem, then we recommend mold remediation, doing it under containment, making sure that you're removing all the toxic materials. You don't want to leave mold. You don't want to go over it. You don't want to leave it on a wall. It needs to be cut away and cleaned properly. I've been a certified mold remediator for years. I don't do mold remediation because I obviously am an environmental inspector by trade. You know, I obviously know how to do it and have been trained in it. Mm-hmm. But it's really important to do it right. And, you know, sometimes people don't want to spend the extra money. But if you have mycotoxin exposure and you have them in your house, they're very, very small, like smaller than a micron. And mm-hmm. these things are very challenging to get rid of. So once you get a problem, if you let it go too far, you know, it can really create a health hazard. So you want to address mold and stuff very, very early in the process. So mm-hmm. that's why I always recommend do a test every 3 to 5 years. You're talking about a couple $100s. It's not a big expense, but it'll keep you from having a health issue down the line where these things get out of control and then you're really sick.
Have you heard of essential oils being used mm-hmm. in remediation?
I have. They used to use what was very successful for many years was grapefruit seed extract.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually used to make, the company actually went out of business and they had this great product. It was an air freshener kind of concept with the grapefruit seed extract. And it was very mm-hmm. well, it did very well at keeping down the mold spores. Unfortunately, I think the company went out of business, but it was excellent. The thing that I get concerned about with the essential oils, and I really have to make this known, is that, you know, whether something's natural or it's synthetic, it adds to your volatile organic load, as it adds to your VOCs. And when I test mm-hmm. VOCs for a living, and mold VOCs can add up to a VOC, but also paints and chemicals and gasoline and essential oils, these fragrances easily can launch your VOCs up. And when you're dealing with people who have asthma, allergies, chronic health issues, high volatile organics make the body have to work a lot harder to process them.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm usually advocating like 15 minutes a day with essential oils because of the side effects that we see when you heat them, especially like heat up with massage or just a vaporizer, diffuser. These particles get very small and can do a lot of damage to the kidneys and the liver, which they've been, you know, studies have been showing us. So I try to minimize like 15 minutes a day, and I'm okay with that. But you have to remember, they do add to your VOC level mm-hmm. for your air quality.
I remember when I was in the MBH program, environmental medicine person, I guess it was, said mm-hmm. the solution to pollution is dilution. So does it help to open your doors and your windows and all of that to lower the POC?
Well, the indoor air quality is always much worse, you know, inside than it is outside.
Mm-hmm.
And that also there's a whole subset there that of preference, right? So if you're living next to a big pharma company, I guess, and they're producing some kind of toxic chemical in the air all the time, then no, you know, you may have a different, my answer mm-hmm. may be different. But the majority of the time, indoor air quality is much more polluted than outside. And you definitely need to exchange the air. And if you, one, open windows, that's great. A lot of now, a lot of the concept is to use energy recovery ventilators and ERV systems to exchange the air, bring in fresh air from the outside. You have to, especially if you're going to store a lot, if you're going to be, you know, having chemicals. People like to put gas in their house. They want to attach cars and automobiles, snow blowers. And you really can't do this because it really puts your carcinogens, one, at a very mm-hmm. high level, but then also your VOCs. So your house is not your storage. I always say have an outside storage area where you can keep these things because it's much healthier, without a doubt. But yes, you want to ventilate as much as you can and bring in fresh air, as long as it's fresh air. You don't want to be bringing mm-hmm. in somebody's dryer vent from outside either.
Right. I wouldn't think that gasoline would be very safe in a house either.
But people store. It's such a, when I test indoor air quality, it's one of the biggest contributors to VOCs. Now, you will, even if you live out in the middle of nowhere and you decide, hey, I'm going to pick up and move to, let's say you're going to move to Pahrump, Nevada,
mm-hmm.
and you don't want to have any chemicals around you, you will have gasoline in your sample.
Oh.
And that's because it's so prevalent in the environment.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime you go to fill your gas tank, for example, you don't have to actually dump gas on yourself. People think, if you just fill the tank and you get out of your car and you fill up, you're covered in gas vapor. And that mm-hmm. comes into your house. And if you sit down on your couch or you sit down in your bed or wherever, you're bringing that into the environment. So people are kind of amazed mm-hmm. when I test because they say, well, where does it come from? We don't have it in the house. I said, you're getting enough of it from just external environments and bringing it in.
Mm-hmm.
So my trick is always like, look, if you're going to get gasoline and you have to pump, like in New Jersey, we don't have to. We don't. You're lucky. We can sit in our car and have our gas pumped for us, which I love.
You can. Oh,
but
I thought
if you have
that
to get
was
out,
gone. Really?
Yeah. No. Yeah. Yeah. We don't pump our own gas here, which I love because I know the detriment of how you pick it up and where it comes from.
Right. No, I didn't realize that was available anywhere anymore.
Yeah, yeah, we still have it. Lucky for me. And but if you do pump gas, it's very important to change your clothes. Like the day you go, I always tell my customers, like, go and pump when you're before you take your shower, and then put the clothes, you know, in the laundry. Because if you just take your clothes off and throw them in the laundry basket, for example, and don't wash your clothes all week, you're breathing in the gasoline vapors. And if you've ever read an MSDS sheet on gas and what it's, you know, what it's made of, you don't want to be breathing that in. So you want to try to minimize those things as much as possible.
I had no idea.
See?
Then what are some easy, low-cost recommendations for homeowners to improve wellness at home?
Well, I think the big thing is monitoring your relative humidity. That's huge because you're going to cut down on all the other things. So if you don't have high humidity, you won't have the potential for mold. You won't have the potential for bugs. You won't have to spray as much pesticide, right? People are always like, well, I have to have bugs. I have to spray. We don't want you doing these things. They're neurotoxins with carcinogenic. Like, you know, look at glyphosate. Glyphosate has become a big issue with Roundup.
Right.
Especially in California, they've really fought to label glyphosate as, you know, carcinogenic under the Proposition 65. So, you know, these things are not benign, and people go out and use them like they are. So the least you have to use them, the better. So controlling moisture is great. You know, you don't have to use as much pesticide. You're not going to have as much dust mites and things that promote inflammation. And then also, you know, vacuuming regularly. I have this rule. So you vacuum as many people as you have in the home. So if you have one person, you got to vacuum once a week. If you have one person and a dog, you have to vacuum two times a week. If you have a person, a dog, and a cat, three times a week. So as many occupants as you have in the home, you have to vacuum, and you should be using what I call a closed sealed system on your vacuum, which doesn't allow any of the debris to come back out. And then also making sure that you're always using a HEPA filter. And the reason you use the closed system is because if you open up your vacuum and you go to pull the bag out and you see dust all around the outside of the bag, you know something's wrong. So it should be all staying in the bag, and you should be able to just dump it out and get rid of the bag and not have to, you know, see that debris or have that debris redeposited back into the environment. So those types of things are really easy to do. You know, it's not cost prohibitive. So everybody can clean better and do the due diligence. And changing your filters regularly is very important. Mm-hmm. Having your HVAC serviced. Every air conditioning has to be serviced every year. I'm a stickler about it because of the condensation coils and things that can build up debris to block them, and you can get floods and leaks. And so air conditioning has to be serviced every year, and heating I can go every other year or so.
Oh, now I have them come every year. Spring and fall.
That's the ideal. That's what I do as well.
Yeah.
But, you know, sometimes money is an issue, right? So I say you can get away with the winter gas, but you want to really make sure you stay on top of the air conditioning.
Right. And I have a humidifier added because it was the dry heat and it was too dry. And so that's one reason I have them come for the heating every year instead of every other year.
Right, because especially if you have a humidifier, they can become problematic because, you know, they get stagnant water, everything. So, but you really want to maintain that level. Like, right, if you go too low on your relative humidity, then you get dried out and you get sick more because your sinuses dry out. And then if you go too high, then you get mold. So that 30 to 50% is like that range that you want to shoot for.
I guess I would think less about environmental factors than I should. Because I focus so much on keeping the immune system up and eating organic and staying vegan and doing all the things I do to strengthen the body. But I don't focus enough on, you know, avoiding toxic environmental factors or eliminating them if possible. So this has been really interesting for me.
Well, the other thing, too, is that you have to remember a lot of these factors can drop the immune system. So if you've got mold exposure, you could be doing XYZ to keep the immune system up. But if the mold is there, you're kind of defeating the purpose. And if it gets bad enough, no matter what you do, and I think there's a subset of the population where they go to physicians, they're eating the diet, they're doing what they can, And I work a lot with doctors who send their patients to me, and they get sent to me when they can't figure it out. They're eating the diet. I had a client the other day who he was doing all the things. He was doing everything the doctor told him. He was at a holistic physician. And the doctor said, look, you need to go talk to Caroline. And sure enough, I mean, he had a mold problem. Mm-hmm. So, and that's what I see traditionally with a lot of these patients. When you get to a point that you don't have answers, don't think you have to be sick. You need to just look at some other avenues.
Along with this are the mental, spiritual, because one of the things that I found when I was reviewing forgiveness is that those who do not forgive create anxiety, which depletes the killer cells in the body. Can you believe that?
Yeah, I can.
And about 60% of all cancer patients have a forgiveness problem, and 50% of those are severe. So I don't think most people think that our spiritual, emotional things affect our body as much as they do. But, you know, I think that that, to me, showed that they affect it very much.
And what do they recommend? So when they talk about people forgiving, right? Because we all say, okay, we forgive someone, but then you subconsciously, right, can harbor onto something. I mean, we all have done it. I mean, I've done it. So what do they say is really in the forgiveness process, how do they recommend you forgive, right? So even if you may psychologically think you have, but you're still holding on to it.
Right.
Are there tips that they give you to try to...
Well, a lot of it has to do with affirmations. And mm-hmm. one that I like very much is, I forgive you for not being the way I want you to be. I forgive you and I set you free. Because I think that often when we get upset with people, it's because we want them to be a certain way and they aren't that way. And it's part of the learning process that you love unconditionally, I guess is the best way to say it.
Yeah, that's very true.
So a lot of it, to me, a lot of it has to do with using affirmations. I forgive so-and-so for such-and-such, and I set you free, and then visualizing, it is part of that process, also visualizing or hearing the person say, thank you, I forgive you also. So to me, a lot of it is using affirmations and visualization to overcome the feeling, and it does work.
Yeah. And I think too, because it is so, you know, you in your mind can think you forgave someone, but in your heart,
mm-hmm.
you know, you
mm-hmm.
still have that sadness or resentment or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that's a really good tip. I will adopt.
Then, Caroline, are there other things you'd like to say before we look at your services book?
I think just, you know, really that people, when you don't have an answer and you've been sick, you know, you really need to just look at your environmental factors. It's important. And we're learning a lot more. You know, we really didn't look at it years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know,
mm-hmm.
I've been doing this 17 years. And back then, people looked at me like I had two heads. And now it's becoming mm-hmm. way more understood that, especially people who get cancer, you know, mm-hmm. at the University of Southern mm-hmm. California, there have been studies where if you get cancer and you're a younger person under the age of 25, they really see an environmental link, whether it be the POPs, persistent organic pollutants. So these environmental factors are nothing to ignore, and they definitely are triggers. And I think people need to be kind of more aware that mm-hmm. there are things that can contribute.
Mm-hmm. Then, Caroline, will you tell us about services, products, books, or other things that you have?
Sure. So the name of our company is My Healthy Home. We're located in New Jersey, but we service the entire United States, as well as we do international as well. But, you know, basically the services, we test for everything pertaining to the home. So if people are interested in testing for Vault Organics to find out how much, you know, chemicals they're exposed to, if they're interested in testing for proteins, that could be dog, cat, horse. Peanut is a big one. A lot of children have peanut allergies.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes important to test homes for things like that. Mold, that's what we do. So people can find us at healthyhomeexpert.com, or they can go to My Healthy Home. We have a website there as well. That's for, you know, our services. We do consultations. We work with physicians. We also have a lot of podcasts and videos and media, just like mm-hmm. this one that we have on our site, where people can just get educated about environmental health and mm-hmm. and look into keeping their environment as healthy as they can. It's something that you invest in, just like your body. So once a year, you should do a test. You know, you don't have to go crazy, but once a year, do some test to try to assess how your environment is or how healthy it is for you.
And
just to stay on top of it.
Your website?
It's healthyhomeexpert.com. Mm-hmm. Or you can just Google My Healthy Home, which is our company.
Great. Well, I appreciate this very much, Caroline. It's very, very interesting. And I look forward to talking with you again one day.
Thank you so much for having me. It's mm-hmm. been eye-opening.
Thank you. My second guest, Vanita Lott, RN, a certified nurse midwife with high-risk experience. She has attended births and delivered babies in medical centers, hospitals, an independent birth center, and had 10 years' experience as a home birth practitioner. She was called to be a midwife at the age of 16 while reading about the U.S. Air Force Certified Nurse Midwives. She has a Bachelor's of Science in Nursing from William Patterson College in New Jersey in 1981, with honors, graduated from Frontier School of Midwifery with a GPA of 3.87 in 1997, and is certified by the American College of Nurse Midwives Board. Her hospital experience includes high-risk experience in New Jersey, New York, Washington, Arizona, Nevada, and California. She is an avid student of alternative holistic healing practices, including naturopathy, herbal medicine, sound and spiritual healing. She is also a certified yoga teacher and Reiki hands-on healing practitioner. She loves kayaking, hiking, ecstatic dance, yoga, meditation, being in nature, being with family and friends. More information is available at linkedin.com/Vanita-Lott-A4A7671. I welcome you to the Holistic Health Show, Vanita, and I look forward to hearing about C-sections. First, what is a cesarean? And what is the cesarean rate in the United States?
Well, a cesarean is a surgery to remove the baby through the mother's abdomen, and it's a major abdominal surgery with all the risks of surgery and anesthesia, and there's more risks for the mother and the baby. Obviously, if the cesarean is life-saving, those risks are well worth it. But the United States now has a 32% cesarean section rate, so we have almost 1 in 3 of all births in the United States being delivered by cesarean section, and that is a very dangerous and disconcerting number.
Mm-hmm. And what is considered a reasonable rate?
The World Health Organization says the cesarean rate should be more around 10%. And there's under no circumstances over 15%.
Why is it so high in the United States?
You know, to me, like, there's a lot of factors for it. Like, on my website, I wrote this whole long essay outlining all of them. And say that it's because we have this very extreme technological and medical approach that can be really useful with high-risk labors and pregnancies, and I've had a lot of high-risk experience being a nurse midwife. I have delivered babies in medical centers also, and estimated I've been around 1,500 births in my career. So there's a lot of reasons for it, but this approach, we're not making a distinction between like healthy labors. Like, the best you can get from the medical profession is calling a pregnancy low risk. Like they don't even refer to a pregnancy as healthy. It's like low risk. And we need to have a very different approach to healthy pregnancies, which I like to call healthy pregnancies, versus high risk pregnancies. And I also had a home birth practice for 10 years in this county where I live in Northern California, right? So in the home birth practice, you know, things were very, I call it low tech and high touch, you know, very personalized, very individualized care, where you have the midwife with you all the time and you have an assistant and they're just focused on you, as compared to in the hospital where there's sometimes, like, even the hospital administrators have sometimes called it like assembly line care. This very unbalanced technical medical approach to birth. There's tons of interventions being used routinely in normal labors. It results into what is called the cascade of interventions, where you do one intervention. Like something as simple as putting someone on an electronic fetal monitor, which is this monitor that they women are attached to. It has cords that record the contractions through the abdomen, even though that's not highly accurate, and then the baby's heart rate. We know that when we've known this since the 80s when they were introduced. We've known since the 1980s. That just attaching a woman to an electronic fetal monitor, and there are cases where women have to be attached to monitors in very high-risk situations and stuff, but at normal healthy labors attached to electronic fetal monitors consistently increase the C-section rate. Because you see things, you know, in the beginning, like we were seeing stuff that we didn't even know how to interpret and we were intervening. But I've been with national experts who don't agree about how to interpret these graphs. And even though the electronic fetal monitor, like it seems to make sense rationally, like, oh, okay, well, if you watch the baby all the time, we'll be able to intervene, you know, when there's a problem. And you would think it might have improved statistics. But what happens is, and I'm calling it actually tethering women to these monitors, because when you have a woman attached to these monitors, women quickly learn not to move because it disrupts the grafts, right? And some of the machines even make beeping sounds and stuff like that. So women learn not to move. If you watch a woman, like say in a very natural setting, such as her home, in labor, they're practically perpetual motion machines. They're constantly moving and shifting, right? And to get more comfortable, and on a monitor, women aren't moving. So they decrease the circulation to the uterus, which makes the uterus not function as well. And it decreases the circulation to the baby. So you're setting yourself up for babies not getting enough oxygen supply and actually causing problems. Mm-hmm. So that's one intervention that most people are probably fairly familiar with that can lead to a lot of problems. But the other thing, besides this techno-medical approach, to me, I think people have to look at a much bigger level. Really look at a super big picture. And we are living still in a patriarchal society. I know a lot of people, you know, feel like women's rights in the U.S., and they have. They've improved a lot. But we're still in a patriarchal, male-dominated society. And that's permeated everything, including the way Western medicine thinks and the way we approach things. And I'm not saying that physicians are conscious of this. I think this is very unconscious for a lot of professionals. But if you study, like, medical anthropologists, birth is an act of power. You know, I mean, it's obvious that a woman giving birth is the perpetuation of the human race, right? It's an act of power. And in a patriarchal society, it's set up to disempower women, right? Because men want to be superior. And like I'm saying, I'm not saying like someone's obstetrician, male obstetrician, is thinking about this necessarily, because I think a lot of us don't really think about the cultural context where things came from. To me, men couldn't usurp women's ability to give birth because they just physically can't give birth. And so the next best thing, I think, was to dominate women. And it's really typical after a lot of hospital births, you see women, even after totally like normal births, you see women laying down exhausted and they're taking pain medications and they're taking narcotics and they kind of look like they've been through the war. And I'm not saying that cannot happen, you know, doesn't happen at home too, because obviously, you know, I've had very long labors at home and stuff where women were exhausted at the end. But in general, I was really struck when I was doing home births, like there'd be women up making tea 2 hours later. I saw a lot more women weren't wiped and exhausted, and like nobody at home took narcotics after they had a normal birth. And so I think we have to think about it from this patriarchal point of view and start to shed some light on that. I'm personally convinced that the system, it's set up to disempower women.
Then, Vanita, what are the risks and harms of cesareans for the mother, for the baby, family, for society?
You know, there are so many of them. Like, well, obviously for a woman, right, there's all the regular risks of surgery, right? So you can have excessive bleeding. You can have anesthesia complications. You know, a woman is scarred. Like a lot of women, I mean, everybody knows, most women know that there's this, you know, the bikini cut scar after a cesarean. But most people, and women say to me a lot, oh, well, you know, well, then I don't have to go through labor. But they don't realize they're going to be in severe pain after the birth. Nature set up birth so that women go through discomfort in labor, but then it disappears when the baby's born, right? And they shift into this totally different mode. But with a cesarean, you have the severe pain afterwards, which interferes with a mother bonding with her baby, because now she's on narcotics and she's usually dealing with a lot of her own, you know, just physical stress. Well, women actually die more even from planned cesareans, so that's not terribly common. We do know that the infant mortality rates and the maternal mortality rates are going up in the United States. They've been going up ever since I started my career in 1983. And one small part of that is the C-section rates, because, you know, we do know that. I think it's about 1 in 1,600 women die, you know, if 1 in 1,600 cesareans. But women, after the baby's born, you know, they need really complex medical care. They're attached to EKG machines and IVs and urinary catheters. They can't even get up and, like, pick their baby up. They get more wound problems from the incision. They wind up getting hospitalized. It just goes on and on and on. We know, and this is more recent data, like, you know, there's things when we interfere with nature's design that people don't think about, but it's totally common. We know babies born by cesareans have more breathing difficulties when they're born because they didn't go, especially if there was no labor, it's even worse because labor prepares a baby chemically to breathe. But also there's a squeeze through the birth canal that squeezes a lot of fluid out of the lungs to help the baby breathe, and they don't get that. So babies need more help afterwards. There's altered bonding, like I said, with the mother. There's a lot more breastfeeding difficulties because you've interfered with what we call the golden hour, which is when most babies will breastfeed much more instinctually. We've interfered with that. But I think what's fascinating that's come out is we know that babies born by cesareans have an altered immune system development. And it's been proven, like there was a study in the New England Journal of Medicine, that children born by cesarean have more allergies, they have more asthma, and they have more autoimmune disease.
Mm.
And if you think about this, babies, I find it fascinating. Babies were designed to be born, you know, vagina where mm-hmm. there's pee and there's poop. You would think that women would get a lot of, like, if they have tears or stuff, they would get a lot of infections. But because we're not supposed to be doing episiotomies anymore, except mm-hmm. which is a surgical cut of the vagina, that's been shown to not to be used except in certain more extreme circumstances. But women don't get infections there. Nature designed that babies come out there. And when they're born through the mother's vagina and then they're taken in the mother's arms, they're inoculated with the mother's bacteria. So it's supposed to be sterile, ideally, in the womb. So they're inoculated with the mother's bacteria. And we know that babies being born by cesarean section, they're being born in a sterile environment. They're getting inoculated, like, with the hospital bacteria and the doctor's bacteria and the nurse's bacteria. That is looking to be, like, a really big problem for children's health. So again, these things are worth doing if it's a life-saving measure. But to have so many cesareans that were unnecessary, which I'm calling unnecessarians, or that were preventable, because I call them all unnecessarians, but they really can be broken down into unnecessary and preventable cesareans. We should not be exposing mothers mm-hmm. and babies.
What can women do to reduce the risk of unnecessary cesareans?
Well, you know, the reason I started really publicizing this and started this whole website was I think first women need to, like, they need to understand that it's even a problem. I think a lot of people, I know because I talk to a lot of people, obviously, about this. Even though it's gotten a lot of media attention and it's in Consumer Reports and Harvard talks about it and the Mayo Clinic and it's really everywhere, a lot of people are not aware that it's even a problem. And a lot of people don't seem to realize that there are so many risks to cesarean. So I think that's a good start.
Mm-hmm.
We definitely... If I had to sum it up, there's like a lot of things, but if I was going to sum it up, I would narrow it to three things. Again, this is the big picture. One, we need national health care because part of the problem with our bad statistics in the U.S. is there are still a lot of women who have problems accessing prenatal care and getting good prenatal care. So to me, we need single payer. We need national health care.
Mm-hmm.
To solve that problem. The next huge solution that, you know, Harvard talks about, the Mayo Clinic talks about it, the U.S. government's talked about it for years, we need more midwives. Part, you know, midwives used to be who took care of women, and over the past couple hundred years, it moved to male physicians and hospital births, but as a nurse midwife, like I said, most nurse midwives deliver babies. We don't like to say deliver babies unless we have had to help a baby out with special maneuvers, but because we know the mother is the one who's delivering the baby. But we need more nurse midwives taking care. We need to get more balance. We have to mitigate this really intense patriarchal, male-dominated type of over-medicalization of birth, you know? So I think, so we need national health care, we need more midwives. And then we know from the research that one of the most important things that a woman can do is if she's choosing to deliver in a hospital, that she needs to choose a hospital with a low cesarean section rate.
Mm-hmm.
It seems that doing that is a major thing because hospitals all have their own sort of cultures,
mm-hmm.
you know, and there's, like, I was an intern as a student at Sutter Davis Hospital in Davis, California, and they have the lowest C-section rate in California, which mm-hmm. is 12%. And, like, they're always heralded, and they have a really famous national model nurse midwifery program. They have a very active nurse midwife program and work with obstetricians who are real champions of the midwifery model. So I think if people, you know, should consider nurse midwifery care, they should find a hospital with a low C-section rate. We should be pushing for single payer.
Mm-hmm.
Those would be like the three
mm-hmm.
Main things women should consider. You know, I know
Thank you.
Can't choose to have national health care, but mm-hmm. we can start moving in that direction.
Right. Now, if you have services, books, or products, if you'll tell us about them and also how the listeners could reach you.
I started a website that launched February 4th. It's called awakeningbirthnow.com.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my website. We also have an Awakening Birth Now YouTube channel and Facebook page.
Mm-hmm.
And people can also contact me at 530-205-0168. Or they could email me at awakeningbirthnow@gmail.com.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, I appreciate this very much, Vanita, and I am happy that you're presenting this. I have not had anyone talk about cesareans or midwifery before, and so this will be something new for everyone. So I thank you.
Thank you so much.
I thank you for joining me today on the Holistic Health Show, and I hope some of the information will be useful to you. I invite you to my websites, holistichealthshow.com, where you will find all shows for the past 7 years under the blog. You will also find much of the research on natural ways to deal with cancer and other health conditions, and can sign up for my free monthly newsletter. On my website, beatlungcancer.net, you will find many of the 135 interviews from radio and television over the past 2 years about my book on treating lung cancer naturally and holistically when I was diagnosed 41 years ago next month and given 6 months to live by traditional medicine who offered chemo and surgery. This book was published in November 2012 and was a bestseller on Amazon. You will find endorsements of the book, a place to buy the book, and an earlier one from 2007 titled Healthy Holistic Aging, A Blueprint for Success. On my third website, you will find information on the Carl O'Helvey Holistic Cancer Foundation, begun last year and currently in the phase of completing the website. This site is at www.holisticcancerfoundation.com. Information on how the foundation differs from others, board members, research on holistic natural ways to deal with cancer, including mental and spiritual interventions, interviews with cancer physicians and survivors, and more. If you would like to donate to the work I am supporting, there is a tab to donate, and I can offer you a tax exemption receipt if living in the United States. I also invite you to join me on Facebook at my Facebook page, www.facebook.com/Carl Helvey. On my Holistic Health Show page at www.facebook.com/pages/Holistic Health Show, and the Carl O'Helvey Holistic Cancer Foundation page at www.facebook.com/beatlungcancernaturalalternative. On LinkedIn, I invite you to join me under my name, Dr. Carl O'Helvey. On Twitter, I invite you to join me at www.twitter.com/HolistHealthShow, HolistHealthShow. I wish you a great week, and I look forward to having you here in 2 weeks. I'm Dr. Carl O'Helvey, your host.